Shah never failed to stand by the United States. Kissinger described the Shah as a man whom seven American presidents had lauded as a loyal ally. It was certainly a big blow for Washington to see the Shah ousted. The newly established government viewed both the United States and the Soviet Union as malicious forces in international politics. The United States was referred to as the Great Satan, and it was the main backer of the Shah and posed the most immediate danger to the Islamic Revolution. And the Soviet Union was regarded as a lesser Satan, as it was not seen as closely involved with the former Pahlavi regime. The most dramatic symbol of the Islamic Revolution's determination to assert its independence was the seizure of the American embassy in Tehran in November of 1979 by a number of students. Angered by the US administration of the Shah, they asked Washington to hand over the former despot, a request that was never met. Iran's relations with the Soviet Union and its allies were also tense, although significantly less dramatic. Tehran was opposed to numerous Soviet international policies, particularly its invasion of Afghanistan. In 1988, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, sent a letter to then-Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, warning him of an imminent danger. The letter has gone down in history as an insightful and prophetic letter from the leader of an independent nation to a superpower. Imam Khomeini's letter said, "If you hope at this juncture to solve the economic problems of socialism and communism by appealing to the centres of Western capitalism, you will, far from remedying any ill of your society, commit a mistake, which those to come will have to erase." The post-revolutionary Iran has now consolidated itself regionally and globally, forming warm relations with independent countries in the region and elsewhere in the world. With the Soviet Union gone, Iran has also pursued a look to the East policy, engaging in close collaboration with Russia and China. The independent Islamic Republic of Iran is regarded as a regional power who has contributed a lot to stability in West Asia region, demonstrated by the role it played in defeating Daesh terrorists in Iraq, Syria, and beyond. 43 years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini's words still resonate, and his powerful ideas of liberation from imperialist domination, independence in domestic and foreign affairs, and embrace of social justice and harmony continues to inspire people worldwide.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to your show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
So today we want to talk about an outstanding Shiite figure who spent most of his life regarding the field of Islamic hikmah or philosophy. Of course, philosophy in the Western term and hikmah in the Eastern Islamic terms are two different fields of studies, but he is mainly known as the Shiite philosopher and faqih of contemporary Iran, the late Ayatollah Mahdi Hayri Yazdi, the son of Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi. Sheikh Ziyani, Allah to start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life of Mahdi Hayri Yazdi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Late Ayatollah Sheikh Mahdi Hayri Yazdi is the son of the grand Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Hayri Yazdi, the establisher of the Islamic Seminary of Qom. And Sheikh Mahdi Hayri Yazdi was born in 1923 in Qom. And he started his Islamic studies in the city of Qom under the supervision of his father. He had different teachers in Qom, like late Ayatollah Hujjat Kuh Kamari or Sayyid Muhammad Taghi Khansari Rahmatullah Alayh, and even Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayh and Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani, that these two late figures are his professors in philosophy and hikmat.
That's right.
Late Sheikh Mahdi Hayri Yazdi is known because of his studies in philosophy. Of course, he was a prominent scholar in fiqh and usul, in jurisprudence and its, you know, basics. But he is famous because of his works and studies in Islamic philosophy and even Western philosophy.
That's right.
And the point that he starts, you know, studying philosophy and teaching philosophy in a way that be a figure, a world figure regarding this, is that from the moment that he is sent to United States by late Ayatollah Burujerdi Rahmatullah Alayh, who was the grand marja at that time.
That's right.
And late Ayatollah Burujerdi sent some, you know, representatives to different countries, yes, like Hijaz, like, you know, Africa, like England, like Germany, and also United States. That Sheikh Mahdi Hayri is sent to United States, and when he enters the United States, he decides to have some preaching regarding Islamic studies, and he finds out that he need to get familiar with the culture and with the academic language of the society, so mm-hmm. that he enters the university
okay.
in bachelor degree and MA, and then even in PhD degree that he participated in Toronto University of Canada.
Yes. So Georgetown University was the university he studied in. Georgetown,
yes, in bachelor.
Bachelor,
in bachelor,
yes.
But
yes,
the PhD was Toronto University in Canada.
Okay.
So beside studying philosophy in these universities, started teaching there, and besides, you know, having these courses at university, he had his activities in Muslim society in the United States of America.
That's all right. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, the main field of study of Mahdi Hayri Yazdi is philosophy. Let's differentiate between the philosophy and the hikmah, these two, different fields of studies. Because from one side, he's becoming familiar with the philosophy in the Western fashion and the Western tradition. And from the other side, he's the son of one of the greatest ulama. He is a Rouhani himself, wearing turban, you know, and imama, you know, and this cleric robe here and there. And has studies on Mullah Sadra, you know, and other fields of study. It becomes really difficult for a teacher or for a master or a professor regarding, academic studies to have mastery over both of them, the Western philosophy and the Eastern one. How did he manage this field of study?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you said, it's four different fields of study. When any student of seminary school enters the seminary, after participating for some years, he is facing two, four different sections, either to take the field of study of Manqul or what has something to do with the ahadith and traditions and narrations, and other field of study which has something to do with the ma'qul, philosophy, kalam, and the other things must be categorized under this field of study. But it's really interesting that when it comes to Ayatollah Sheikh Mahdi Hayri Yazdi, we see that he had mastery over both field of study, as we see that in his academic career, this is mentioned that he was teaching Kifayatul Usul, which is regarded as one of the top lessons in usul fiqh and or let's say principle of jurisprudence of Shia. So for someone to teach this and at the same time you see that he has entered philosophy and mastered philosophy and hikmah, and when he moves to United States, as my brother mentioned, and in Canada, he graduated from McGill University and Toronto University.
Yes.
So he is capable to teach both field of studies in different universities of the West. Right. So in Michigan University, in as it is said in Howard University, he has been teaching fiqh, he has been teaching philosophy, he has been teaching Persian literature and other field of studies that it is really difficult for normal individual, normal students to get mastery over.
Also analytical philosophy, which is a field very much related to the Western fashion and Western tradition of the philosophy, was taught by him, you know, in the Western universities. And shows his mastery over...
Yeah, he has a very big academic career, as it is said, to teach philosophy in Montreal University, Oxford University, in New York, in Yale University, he was teaching philosophy. So this is not easy. Although he was not employed in these universities as a faculty member, but to be qualified to the extent that you get invitation to go there as a visiting professor to teach these subjects, it's really difficult and better to say it's kind of dream for normal students of Hausa or seminary students.
Also philosophy of ethics at the Toronto University, which is really an interesting field of study. Okay, Sheikh Ziaynia. One of the controversial issues addressed by Mahdi Hayri Yazdi is regarding the concept of hukuma, or the authority, okay? So he brings this concept under the shadow of the concept of wakala, or deputyship, isn't it? And not the wilaya, or the guardianship. What's your take on that? Of course, there were so many, you know, criticism writing on that by Ayatollah Javadi Amali, you know, Ayatollah Mu'min, and the other people, Sayyid Abbas Husseini Qaim Maqami and the other ones, you know, right? And he answered them in an answered and question way. There were so rebuttals. What's your commentary on his view, brother?
If we want to go deep into this subject, we should trace back the origin of authenticity in Islamic resources, that the authenticity and, you know, governorship in Muslim society is belong to whom? According to majority of Muslim scholars, the authenticity and governance in Muslim society belongs to Allah, Almighty God, in origin.
Yes.
And by His hand, I mean by His, you know, permission, it's gifted to a Holy Prophet and, you know, His successors that are Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salatu
was-salam. That's right.
So this governance is wilayat. You know, wilayat is not something different from governance.
Yes.
They have authority
to
give orders, and people should accept these orders.
Okay.
But the problem is regarding the occultation period.
The Asrul Ghibah.
Yes, Asrul Ghibah. That in this period, because we don't have access, you know, directly to Imam, so but we need government in the society. So if we have a Muslim country and the government is the hand of a Muslim governor, should we count him as a just governor that is given permission by Almighty Allah? Or no, we should count him as a person who is an oppressor and who has usurped position of governance. So this is a critical question that scholars try to answer. Some of which, like Imam Khomeini and some other scholars, they believe that, okay, at this era even, we need to have a person who is a prominent scholar, and this scholar is gifted by Almighty God through the chain that we mentioned, it's gifted to Holy Prophet, to Ahlul Bayt, and then at the occultation time, because we don't have direct access to Imam, so a closer person who is a faqih, a prominent faqih, must be at that position.
This is the velaya-based theory of governance or authority.
Yes.
Now, what is the wakala one? Because Mahdi Hayri Yazdi was the supporter of the wakala one, okay?
Mahdi Hayri Yazdi and some others even, we have some other figures, They say that, no, the authenticity at the time of occultation belongs to people.
Okay.
Not to faqih.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, it belongs to people, and people are the ones who are choosing some, you know, figures to rule over their society.
Okay.
So if the faqih is there,
mm-hmm.
so it must have the permission of people.
People, okay.
So either
this permission is by voting or something like that?
Yes, yeah, okay. Yeah. So even, you know, through the acceptance by society. Maybe there is no election, but mm-hmm. people are accepting him
yes.
by their hearts and they are following his yes. orders. If it is like this,
yes.
so the governance is acceptable
yes.
and his orders is accepted, but up to the point that people accept
yes.
him. If
yes.
they reject him,
yes.
he is basically
okay.
resigned.
Mm-hmm.
But in the theory of Wilayat al-Faqih, if
yes.
people do not accept a person, he is not basically resigned.
That's right.
But again, he will give up the government
That's
to
right.
people. He won't kill the people because
okay.
of governing over
yes.
them. He will resign and stand aside. But they say, the people who believe in the theory of Wilayat al-Faqih, they say that, again, he is at that position.
Yes.
But because people are not listening to him,
okay.
he is not in a position to, you know, give instructions.
Yes.
But he is, again, at that position. The same thing that we are saying at the time of the caliphate of the first and second and
yes.
third caliph, that
okay.
we say that Imam Ali alayhi salam was at the position
of the
but
imamate.
He had no, you know, they were not listening to him.
Okay.
So this is the difference, that whether basically faqih is at that situation with the permission of people or with the permission of God.
Of God. So from one side, in the velaya-based authority or velayat al-faqih, the legitimacy comes straight from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Prophet Muhammad, infallible imams, and at the time of the occultation, he is the representative of, it's better to say, this velaya system giving authority. But in the vakala system, you know, the population, the people, and the legitimacy is over there.
And there are some problems regarding the wakala system. For example, who gives this authority to people?
Mm-hmm.
And if we believe like this, so why the people are not having this authority at the time of the Holy Prophet?
Okay.
So we should answer these critical questions.
But the case is that in the Islamic Republic of Iran system, which is based on Velayat al-Faqih now, the case is that the people at first hand vote for the members of Majlis-e-Khobragan, or the elite assembly, okay, of the leadership. And based on their opinions, the next leader or the Vali-e-Faqih of Iran is going to be chosen. So at the same time, it is somehow based in the legitimacy of the votes of the people too, isn't it?
Yeah, this is kind of...
But the selection of Vali-e-Faqih is based upon the knowledge of those members of the assembly.
So it shows that this is not directly anymore, as my brother mentioned.
Okay.
At the system of vekala, it is directly upon the wish or will of the people.
People, that's right.
So from tomorrow, if they decided to withdraw or take their vote back,
mm-hmm.
so the system is not going to operate anymore.
Okay.
With or relying on that person who had mm-hmm. been chosen
yes.
as the governor. This is based on the system of vekala. But in Islamic Republic of Iran, we are benefiting from the system which was a kind of merging between these two things.
Okay.
So we have people on one hand, and on the other hand, we see that still this authenticity comes through Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Why? Because we say that people are going to vote in favor of their representative
yes.
who are going to gather together in the elite assembly, which is Majlis-e-Khobragan.
Yes.
And those people must be qualified of some certain qualifications. They must
right.
be faqih.
Yes.
Meaning jurists.
Yes.
They must be mujtahid.
Yes.
They must be just. They
yes.
must be expert and having expertise in different field of study of Islam. So
they have the power in order to recognize who would be the true manifestation or spirit actualization of the theory of Velayat al-Faqih, that is Vali of the society, isn't it?
Yes. Then that in the elite assembly, which is Majlis-e-Khobragan, these representative of people,
yes,
they will gather together
mm-hmm.
and sit having their meeting,
yes.
their discussions, and coming to this point that this person is qualified
okay.
to lead and govern
over the people.
And after choosing one person, they keep monitoring him.
Mm-hmm.
This is not to say, okay, if someone is chosen, they keep monitoring him based on keeping with the lines of Islam. This is also is not based on the wish.
That's right.
That, okay, since this person is not keeping with our wish, so we are going to put him aside. No, they are going to supervise his actions and activities based on the Islamic standards.
That's right. But the wakala system is also in the Islamic Republic of Iran by selecting the president of Iran, isn't it? It is upon the direct wish of the people who to select, not to select.
In Islamic Republic of Iran, as Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned, you know, we have a mixed type of these two, you know, different ideas, ideologies. For example, the president is chosen directly by people.
Yes.
But you know that president is gifted the authenticity by the Wali Faqih.
Yes.
So these are combined to each other.
The legitimate, you know, power and permission is given by the rahbah. Yeah.
So, but executive power, is in the hand of the president, and he is chosen by people. Yes, so Wali Faqih is giving this legitimacy to him, and then the country is ruled by people again.
That's all right.
This was, in fact, an analysis, or as better say, a commentary and answer to some of the questions or better ideas posed by Mahdi Hariri as the one of the most outstanding, you know, philosophers of contemporary Iran.
And we should know that this discussion has different aspects. We didn't mention all of them. We just talked about some very, you know,
limited parts of it. Of this part. And as I said, there were also so many answers by Ayatollah Javadi Omali, Ayatollah Mo'min, and so many of others. You know, if people are interested, they can refer to the texts which are available you know, on the websites, different websites over there. This outstanding man passed away in 1999. His body was taken into the holy shrine of Lady Masuma in the city of Qom, and he was buried over there. May Allah bless his soul. Thank you much, Sheikh Ziyaniya.
You're most welcome.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, thank you very much.
You're most welcome, brother.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. This was Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Call of Islam page. Also, YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye. A symphony of nature. It's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website,
www.parstoday.com/en.
Depleted uranium made a spectacular entrance on the battlefront in 1991. During the first Persian Gulf War, bombs and shells made with this high-density metal annihilated Saddam Hussein's tanks. And since then, the U.S. military have regarded depleted uranium munitions as the magic weapon. For those who use it, depleted uranium is beyond reproach. But others say it is a deadly poison. So who's right and who's wrong? Many countries possess weapons based on depleted uranium. And experimentation has been rife. But the consequences for civilians and the military alike have been dramatic. Today's documentary, Depleted Uranium, a Very Presentable Killer, compares and contrasts the arguments of those who defend and attack a technology that is highly toxic. Stay with us for the first part.
It's a wonderful weapon. Depleted uranium is a very dense, hard metal. And you put it on the end of a bullet, or you put it on the end of a shell, and it'll go through a tank and go through the second tank. I mean, it's wonderful from a military standpoint.
Based on the fact that certain armies around the world are developing new armor plating capabilities, which can't be pierced other than by depleted uranium munitions, it's quite normal to conserve a high-level operational capability that the French army envisages equipping its Leclerc tanks with this type of munitions.
I was trying to say, hey, guys, you may be creating a problem. I have been very careful not to accuse because, you know, j'accuse is a pretty strong thing to say to somebody.
My name is Jacques Charmelot. I've been a journalist for 30 years. I've covered conflicts in Africa, Iran, Lebanon, Iraq, and in the Balkans. And I've worked in Washington, a secret and powerful city. On July the 4th, 2012, I'm in America's federal capital. I'm in the crowd attending the Independence Day parade. But my thoughts are elsewhere. I'm back from a battleground that the American soldiers have just left, Iraq. Barack Obama has put an end to more than 20 years of war-torn confrontation between the U.S. and this distant country. But what I saw there is indelibly etched on my memory. trail of depleted uranium begins in Iraq. Iraq has been subjected to more than 50 years of revolutions, dictatorships, and wars. And it's trying with all its might to be reborn. But its poisoned past weighs heavy on the fate of 30 million Iraqi citizens. My investigation begins in Basra, a huge port caught between Iran, Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia. In February 1991, it is at the heart of the international offensive to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. The Iraqi tanks want to leave the small emirate, but American planes, masters of guise, are waiting for them. I head for the scene of the Iraqi rout.
I took part in the war in Kuwait against the American forces.
Could you tell us about leaving Kuwait? How it happened for you?
I fought in the war up to the very end until the Iraqi army retreated, but it wasn't so much a retreat as every man for himself. The road was exposed and the planes bombarded our military forces. That was the situation with our tanks. The road was open and straight, and it was very easy for the Americans to bomb our tanks. It was this the road of death.
The final battle in the war lasted just 10 hours. Hundreds of tanks and vehicles were blown into shreds and abandoned in the desert. Much later, an official American document explains why the success was so devastating. On the road of death, American pilots used a newcomer to their weaponry arsenal. They fired thousands of rounds containing at least 320 tons of depleted uranium. The rounds are equipped with a depleted uranium arrowhead penetrator, which can pierce any armor plating. They catch fire on impact, reaching over 1,000 degrees, igniting the target and emitting a cloud of fine dust. They are real tank killers. Four countries are the main producers: the United States, Russia, China, and France. Natural uranium is used in numerous countries. Once enriched, it becomes highly radioactive and is used in atomic weapons and nuclear power stations. The residue of the enrichment process is called depleted uranium. It is weakly radioactive, but is not degradable. It has to be securely stored or recycled. 50,000 tons are produced around the world every year. In Basra, depleted uranium is accused of leaving a terrible legacy. I head for the city's central hospital.
Are you being treated?
Yes, I'm still being treated. Until God takes my soul. They diagnosed cancer in my pancreas and then my liver. You know, the countries that started the wars don't come to help us. They poured their poison on us and then they went away.
In 1991, the first Gulf War started, and at that time I was here on a duty at night duty, when the airplanes, fighters and bombs. After that, by many years, 3 or 4 years, we start to see many cases of cancer, particularly in this hospital. If we compare it to the 80s or 90s, we found there is an increase of, say, fourfold. 1996, somebody came here with a delegation, escorting a delegation. He's from the security, and he knows about the problem, and he told me, "Doctor, you know that we are under the effects of depleted uranium, which is used by the American." Yeah, he just whispered into my ear that we got this problem. And so we start to have a link between the use of depleted uranium and the increased cancer rates. You know, now we have what we call a cancer phobia here among people. Everybody who got a mass, they think that we got a cancer.
Even before Dr. Jawad al-Ali learnt about the dangers of depleted uranium, in 1995, the Americans produced a film alerting its own soldiers to the risks involved with the heavy metal.
Battlefields and fighting are by nature hazardous to your health. some hazards are easy to identify and well understood. Soldiers recognize the serious hazards presented by incoming artillery shells and bullets and take appropriate actions. However, some lesser hazards from new technological applications are not so well known and recognized. One of these newer applications is the use of depleted uranium in munitions and equipment armor.
The film fixes three safety rules for dealing with potential depleted uranium contamination. Get away as far as possible, as quickly as possible, and avoid any exposure to the skin. Three rules that were impossible to respect in Basra. I discover one of the tank cemeteries that abound throughout the city. There are thousands of tons of debris, some of which contaminated by depleted uranium dust, have been accessible to the population here for 20 years. I'll ask the head of the Environment Ministry why such dangerous metal wasn't removed to safety.
After 1991, we had a full report on the sites and their effects. There was no department to deal with it. Every time we found a piece of contaminated metal, we identified it with a red or yellow tag. Before 2003, we put a notice, "Danger, contaminated fragment, do not approach." Shortly after, we'd return to the same place and the notices would have disappeared and we'd find them somewhere else. Even if we deemed it important at the time, it was only relatively important, as the situation was very complex and local authorities had other concerns. Why did the Americans from 2003 and even since 1991 not remove or displace the metal waste? They did nothing at the time. The likely reason, in my view, is that they hadn't yet measured the effects of using this weaponry. They wanted to see the results and the effects after 5, 10, and 15 years, etc. God will decide. But the munitions they used against us will have effects on our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grandchildren for generations to come, probably until the end of time.
During the invasion of Kuwait, Paris was a faithful ally of the USA, and French troops played a crucial role.
Très bien, à tout de suite.
I contact journalist Marie-Claude Dubin, who was at the front line.
There was a tank which looked all burnt up. And I said, "Can I go inside? It's not mine." No, it's not mine. You can go in." I raised up clouds of dust, and I never imagined that the ashes were mixed with depleted uranium dust.
What illness are you suffering from?
An autoimmune disease. I've been told it attacks the nerves, muscles, the thyroid, plus certain neurocognitive problems, neuromuscular lesions.
To get a clearer picture of what happened to Marie-Claude Dubin and to patients in the Basra hospital, I go to Valence to see a scientist. For years, Roland Desbordes has been speaking out against the risks of depleted uranium. He's the president of CRIRAD.
We know that depleted uranium is pyrophoric, which means that it ignites spontaneously in the air, with the oxygen in the air. A flameless combustion, but with oxidization, producing uranium oxide, which is an extremely fine dust that's released into the air. You can then be contaminated internally, either through inhalation, if you're not wearing a mask, or by ingestion, because it'll be on your fingers. The uranium combines many risks, but why? Because it's an alpha emitter, and alpha radiation is what causes the most internal damage. Secondly, because it's a heavy metal, and we retain it. It metabolizes within the organism for many long years. For it to lose half its radioactivity, it takes 4.5 billion years.
4.5 billion years is the same age as planet Earth. These concerns over the harmful effects of depleted uranium dust are shared by official scientific bodies.
The problem is, in the case of internal contamination, either you ingest it because you're in a contaminated environment and it can be found in the water and in food, or you inhale and the particles of depleted uranium reach your lungs. There are two phases to this. Firstly, the uranium particles have to be dissolved to get into the blood, and once they're in the bloodstream, they'll be distributed among the various organs. Once in the organs, either it builds up or it doesn't.
We often refer to the case of the Iraqi children who play in the tanks that were destroyed and who collect the scrap metal and cut it up, or housewives who sometimes recycle the metal to make pots that they'll subsequently cook in. Do you think there's a risk?
There are potential effects, especially if there's repeated exposure, even if it's not chronic. And this will be the case. Children come to play, water is cooked in the pots. With ingestion, with repeated administration within the body, even if you only have weak doses, the fact of accumulating the various doses can ultimately have an effect on health.
Clearly, the depleted uranium dust falls down, and it settles.
Yes. Once it falls, obviously the ground will be contaminated. Afterwards, it depends on how this contamination comes about, if it's very localized or not, and whether it's in towns or in fields which will be cultivated. So there will definitely be a contamination of the environment.
Things are becoming clearer to me, and more worrying. The depleted uranium particles are dangerous for health and for nature. The career of depleted uranium munitions began in Iraq, but it continued in the heart of Europe, just a few hours by air from capital cities like Paris, Rome, and Berlin. I walk among the graves in the Jewish cemetery in Sarajevo. It was from here that Serbian snipers kept the besieged city locked down. The journalists, who like myself, came to cover the conflict, often found themselves behind the yellow walls of the Holiday Inn. In 1992, divisions in Yugoslavia forced Bosnia into a war. In April, the inhabitants of Sarajevo were trapped. The UN launched an impossible mission to reconcile Muslims, Serbs, and Croats. But the war dragged on, and in 1995, NATO intervened. NATO planes, mostly American, bombed the Serbs, who were forced to make peace. The Sniper Alley tramway takes me to Hadići, a suburb on the outskirts of Sarajevo. I enter a ruined factory, a key element in the Serbs' military industry. Tanks and cannons were repaired here. NATO planes attacked the Hadići factory seven times in September 1995. And fired more than 4,000 depleted uranium shells. When peace was reinstated, many Serbs from Hadići moved to Bratunac, a Serbian republic town in eastern Bosnia. They went there to live and also to die. Nedeljko Zelenović is a journalist and a witness. He has investigated the NATO bombings. His father, uncle, cousins, and dozens of friends worked in the Hadići factory.
All the workers who worked on the assembly lines at the time, who were caught in the fighting, and later at the time I was following events, they all died from various forms of cancer. In 1996, the population of Bratunac was between 20 and 22,000 people. And less than 5% of them came from Hadići. That year, in 1996, 154 people were buried in the Bratunac Municipal Cemetery. 3% of them came from Hadice. But in 2000, 105 people were buried in Bratunac, and 50% of them came from Hadice. I have a few names if you're interested.
Jerić Budimir, Andrić Drago, Mastilo Dušan, Banduka Milinko, Banduka Danilo, Aleksić Nenad, Makajić Simo, Stanojević Relja, Puša Ramomir, Turuntaš Ljubica, Lavušić Gospod, Udrić.
What did your son die of?
He was diagnosed with leukemia. I asked what it was caused by, and they told me it was due to depleted uranium.
Mehmed Telalovic is a Muslim. During the war, he fled Hadice, driven out by the Serbs. In 1996, he returned home, close to the ruins of the arms factory. He found his house blown apart by bombs. Mehmed rebuilt it, not suspecting that the land around it had been contaminated by poisonous dust.
We were never told. Nobody ever said anything. The public at large can't even be aware of it, as this disease is really a lottery. You put up with it, you fight it, and you might live or die. I know at least 10 people here, all young, aged between 35 and 40. They all have a cancer.
Mehmet tells me that he discovered he had colon cancer in 2004. He's taken chemotherapy and is now in remission. But the news is not good. The latest tests revealed that his prostate is 4 times bigger than normal. He has blood in his urine.
I've become fragile. Before I could take normal showers. But now I have to have very, very hot showers. I have to wear leggings. I'm cold all the time. I'm delicate. My blood is anemic. I've no immunity.
Are you sure all this is because of the factory?
Oh, yes, I'm 100% certain. There are no other diseases here apart from cancer.
I pursue the depleted uranium trail in Italy. A great ally of the USA within NATO, the country organized humanitarian missions in Bosnia. It later sent a strong contingent to separate Serbs and Albanians in Kosovo. And it was in Italy that the dangers of depleted uranium weapons were widely exposed in late 1999. In Rome, I meet another Italian soldier who'd been sent to the Balkans. Colonel Americo Lacetti.
So it began in
1999.
I came back in 1999, and on December 24th, I had an X-ray. I remember I was alone with the technician. There was nobody at the hospital. When I asked him what I had, he said, "What have you got?" And then he said, "Enjoy Christmas, because you won't be here next year." I had this lump 24 centimeters long, 14 centimeters wide, and 12 centimeters thick, a tumor in my lungs. After that, I had other tests, and they took a piece of the tumor and examined it. Inside were numerous ceramic particles, perfectly round. And they contained a load of substances that don't exist naturally. But they do exist when a depleted uranium projectile strikes a hard surface. This produces a cloud of dust, which when you inhale it, creates this type of pathology. I'm now living in a body that's mined.
As the death toll builds in Italy, the public is outraged, and the government has to act. On January the 3rd, 2001, the Prime Minister, Giuliano Amato, breaks the official silence. and announces that he is going to demand a full account from NATO. But this demand will have little effect.
As the talks continued between Tehran and the P4+1 group of countries, Israel's voice of agony grows louder. Israel has launched a pressure campaign to make sure that the countries negotiating with Iran in Vienna do not agree to what Israeli officials call a bad deal, meaning a deal that allows Tehran to make nuclear bombs. The very idea of building a nuclear bomb is totally rejected by the Iranian government. In 2003, Iran's leader issued a fatwa that forbade the production and use of any form of weapon of mass destruction, which includes nuclear weapons. However, accusing Iran of going after the nukes is a strategy Israel uses to legitimize its hostile stance against Iran. The regime has even beefed up its military activities. In November, Israeli, Emirati and Bahraini naval forces, for the first time, rehearsed joint security operations with the US warship. A month earlier, Israel launched a war game at a desert airbase just north of the port city of Eilat, which sent fighter planes from the occupied territories and seven other countries roaring into the skies. Israel also allocated $1.5 billion to prepare the Israeli armed forces for a potential strike against Iran nuclear sites. In fact, there are near daily warnings from Israeli political and military officials as well. In the latest move in a series of threats, Israel's Minister of War Affairs ordered his forces to prepare a military option. Benny Gantz warned the world that Israel would take matters into its own hands if a nuclear agreement did not constrain Iran the way Israel wants it to.
Recently, the chief of staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. The Iranian nuclear aspiration must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good. But if not, we must stand independently and we must defend ourselves by ourselves.
What Gantz said could be interpreted as a direct threat. However, there are multiple military experts in and outside Israel who believe Gantz's statement was nothing but an empty threat. Several current and former senior Israeli military officials and experts say that Israel lacks the ability to attack Iran. Military experts say Tel Aviv can't pull off an assault that could destroy or even significantly delay Iran's nuclear program, at least not anytime soon. Now, one might ask why carrying out an assault on Iran would be impossible, given the fact that Israel has the latest military weaponry, fighter jets, and support of the United States. True, Israel has a long history when it comes to air attacks, but it won't be as easy as it was when it bombed Egypt, Gaza, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Tunisia, and Syria. Not easy, at least, without potentially catastrophic consequences. To be sure, one could not compare Israel's bombing of such facilities in Iran to its air attacks against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981 or Syria's Al-Kubar facility in 2007. Relik Shafir, a retired Israeli Air Force general who was a pilot in a 1981 strike on an Iraqi nuclear facility, said, "Bombing Iran's nuclear facility is almost impossible." Iran has dozens of nuclear sites, some deep underground, that would be hard for Israeli bombs to quickly penetrate and destroy. The fact is, the Israeli Air Force does not have warplanes large enough to carry such large bombs, so the more protected sites would have to be struck repeatedly with less effective missiles, a process that might take days or even weeks. The other obstacle is geography. If Israel decides to carry out strikes on Iran, its warplanes must fly over 3,000 kilometers to get to Iran. This would cause fuel shortages as the planes have to fly the same amount to go back to Israel. Israel has already ordered jets that can make such flights at a cost of $2.4 billion, but the aircraft are backordered and Israel is unlikely to receive even one before late 2024. There's also the fear of retaliation. Naturally, if Iran gets attacked, it will respond vehemently. Some Israeli planes would almost certainly be lost during the sorties. Their pilots would be killed or taken prisoner, and such losses would have huge consequences for Israel. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of nearly 86 million people, with the potential ability to mobilize its networks all over the Middle East to retaliate. From Lebanon to Palestine and Syria, pro-Iranian forces surrounding Israel could make the regime pay a huge price for any attack. Israel's famous missile system is no good for such a confrontation either. The Iron Dome was never tested in a real battle. It only intercepted man-made Gazan rockets, not real missiles or rockets. It's not even capable of intercepting those handcrafted missiles coming from Gaza. So, if a war erupts, it is safe to say that the Iron Dome can't be much of a help to Israelis. In the meantime, Iran has a formidable missile arsenal of its own capable of precision strikes, which can easily respond to an Israeli bombing of its nuclear sites by going after softer targets.
They always shoot at Israel rockets, but in 2004 or 5, people start to get killed. Make me very annoyed that we don't have a solution. And also, I remember even 91, when Iraq shoot missiles in Israel, we have no solution. You know, everything was... Tel Aviv was empty, okay? They shoot around Tel Aviv. And I decided that we have to do something. Although nothing had been done around the world and everybody said it cannot be done.
One doesn't need to be a general or a strategist to find out that the declarations by the Israeli officials about Israel's readiness for a military strike are empty and pointless rhetoric. All you need is to look at the past few decades. Since January 1995, Israel has been saying that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought and could be less than 5 years away from having an atomic bomb. 27 years later, Israel continues threatening to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. And yet nothing. It's quite clear. Israel is just playing pretend.
IRIB English Radio.